Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to a Scholarly Perspectives episode with Alexandra Benowith, Stephen Burns, Kiara McNair, Ron Reeves, and Kristen Walden. I'm one of your hosts, David.
And I'm your other host, Marla. And in today's special episode, we'll have an expert panel discussing the topic, The Time Is Now, Expert Consensus, Best Practices, and Future Directions for Classifying and Tracking Outcomes for Individuals with Non-Traumatic Spinal Cord Injury. The episode today is sponsored by Asia's Education Committee. So we'd like to just hop right into it with you, Dr. Reeves, and just ask, you know, how is non-traumatic spinal cord defined now, and how is the etiology currently classified, just to give us some background about why this topic is so important?
Thank you so much for the opportunity to participate. It's really an honor to do this today. The classification of non-traumatic spinal cord injury, or non-traumatic myelopathy, or non-traumatic spinal cord disease, has existed now for over a decade, originally outlined in a publication by New and Marshall in Spinal Cord. The classification is a multi-tiered system which allows diseases of the spinal cord to be categorized into a variety of different large buckets of conditions. So degenerative diseases such as arthritis, spinal stenosis, disc herniations are the most common cause of non-traumatic spinal cord conditions in North America, Canada, Europe, Australia. There are some other countries where other causes are more common, but typically degenerative disease is the most common across those locations. After that, tumors, so maybe benign tumors such as a meningioma, or perhaps a malignant tumor like cancer from the kidney, or lung cancer that has metastasized to the spine, would be, generally speaking, the second most common cause of spinal cord disorder. And then beyond that, there are vascular conditions such as AV fistulas, cavernomas, vascular malformations, inflammatory conditions such as normalitis optica, other rare conditions such as B12 deficiency, et cetera. This system that's now being gradually adopted has originally been used in Canada nationwide, at least this first large system. And so I look forward to seeing more from our Canadian colleagues about what they've learned over time. The VA system has also been collecting data for many, many years, and Dr. Burns can speak to what they've discovered from their enormous database of information.
Yeah, thanks. So our registry had its origins in the mid-1990s, so the etiologies, including non-traumatic etiologies, have been on record for a while. With some colleagues, including staff in the SCI National Program Office of VA, we looked at this in 2022 and presented at ACRM and ASCIP. And currently, there are about 7,000 veterans with non-traumatic etiologies in the registry, very similar to what Ron said as far as common etiologies. Degenerative spine conditions are a little over 60%, and then about 10% each, tumors, infections, vascular causes, and so only a tiny percentage for all the other conditions.
Before we dig in further on the history and some of the technical details, Alex, can you come in and tell us why it's so important to be talking about this?
Yes, absolutely. From the community perspective, and again, thank you to Asia for hosting this podcast. Appreciate being here. From the community perspective, individuals with NTSI definitely feel left out of the process. They aren't connected to as many resources, generally speaking. They generally tend to be older. And so it's a domino effect of aging and disabling conditions, unfortunately, that we have to look at. So finding the resources and making sure they have the appropriate resources and they are surrounded by expert staff early enough in the process is the best way to handle it. And we've spent a lot of time at United Spinal collating some resources for all people with SCI. I will mention that MSKTC fact sheet on how to find a rehab hospital that United Spinal worked on with MSKTC. So I appreciate all the work that the model systems are doing. I know you are all at capacity and we push for more funding for all of you. And we have been doing that now that you have the request coming down from NIDLR to look at NTSI data collection as well. So it's just more on you guys to research and to look at. But I also wanted to note, some of you may already know this, I know we're all very grateful for Dr. Anjali Fulber-Pratt and all her leadership at NIDLR, which is the National Institute of Disability and Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. She is actually stepping down in that position starting in July. She has a job at AHD, American Association on Health and Disability, as their director of research. But I know she's put in place a good long-range plan that highlights an expanded commitment to broader inclusion of people with disabilities across the research enterprise, as well as looking at new opportunities for international research and development activities. And I know that it's important for all you as clinicians, as healthcare professionals, for your patients to continue to advocate for better clinical trial participation, more research on NTSCI etiologies, et cetera. And so you can do that with contacting your own legislators and continue the great work that Dr. Fulber-Pratt has done and you all have done so far. So I just wanted to highlight that.
Yes, we all look forward to that professional continuity, and the time is now to start including non-traumatic. If we can, now talk a little bit about why it has been that NTSI non-traumatic hasn't been included in national attempts in the United States, specifically with the Model Systems Registry. Dr. Reeves, you might want to kick us off here.
You know, I think as just with any condition, so one often starts with things that are easier to aggregate, understand, and learn from. And so back, of course, in the 1970s, organized spinal cord injury center care was really still evolving, even in the U.S., although the VA system had defined centers of excellence going back into the 1940s and 50s in the private sector. Traumatic spinal cord injury model system care really began in earnest in the 1970s. As we've learned as a society how to care for people with traumatic spinal cord injury, we've also come to understand, of course, there's a whole other range of conditions that haven't until recently gained much attention, although single centers would be publishing and looking at some things based on their experience. There wasn't aggregated national or international data. There have been some attempts with a series of papers from an international consortium that came about 10 years ago or so. But really, our Canadian colleagues were the leaders in looking at this from a national perspective and beginning to aggregate data. And the U.S. spinal cord injury model system is now interested in it, again, thanks to the leadership of Dr. Fulber-Pratt at NIDLR and her championing of this particular issue.
And just to chime in terms of the Canadian experience, here in Canada, there were a couple of reasons that we wanted to include non-traumatic spinal cord injury, individuals with non-traumatic spinal cord injury into our national registry, which currently is at 30 facilities across 9 provinces in our country. And really largely we were hearing from the network that there were a lot more individuals coming into specialized rehab with non-traumatic spinal cords that they were seeing. And then also really, we had that question in terms of hearing from the community that there were a lot of individuals with non-traumatic spinal cord injuries out there that were having challenges accessing specialized rehab and specialized care around their spinal cord injury. So the registry in Canada, we actually learned a lot from our colleagues in New Zealand who in 2016 implemented a New Zealand spinal cord injury registry that started to collect information on people both with traumatic and non-traumatic injuries at their two specialist services in New Zealand. And they were seeing a higher and higher number proportionally of those with non-traumatic spinal cord injuries as well. And so kind of looking at what that looks like in kind of 2022, 2023, you know, the proportion of those individuals being enrolled in the registry and accessing specialized rehab, where 60% of those had traumatic injuries and 40% had non-traumatic injuries. And that actually aligns with exactly what New Zealand was seeing as well in 2023, which has kind of been an uptick in those with non-traumatic injuries.
And for the VA perspective on this, non-traumatic SCI has definitely been treated in the VA SCI centers for 30 or more years. When the first version of the registry was developed, they named it the Spinal Cord Disorders Registry, so inclusive of traumatic and non-traumatic etiologies. And with the most recent data, patients injured in the last few years or onset of disease in the last few years, for VA, it's slightly in favor of non-traumatic. It's a little above 50% are non-traumatic, so more common than traumatic, which is expected with an older population because the veteran population is older than the U.S. population.
Which may also, the aging of the population may be also contributing to why non-traumatic spinal cord injury seems to be increasing in importance clinically as well. So if we think about the 1970s in particular, the average age for traumatic spinal cord injury was quite young, in the late 20s or so. And of course, over the last 40 years, the average age for traumatic spinal cord injury has gone up as the population is aging as well. And non-traumatic spinal cord injury has an average age, which is quite a bit older. So as overall health and wellness and life expectancy has improved, we may be seeing a changing epidemiology, bringing more people with myelopathy to medical attention, accounting for also why it's over the last decade or so has been viewed as having increasing importance, I think, across both the US and internationally.
Yeah, I totally agree, Ron. And I think looking at the average age, you know, like you said, for traumatic, it's been increasing. And looking at registry data for 2022, the average age for an individual with a traumatic injury was 55. So it's gone up significantly over the years. And for an individual with a non-traumatic cord injury, it was 62. So still older, but I think that's definitely one of the reasons that we're seeing more and more.
One of the things that's also quite apparent with non-traumatic spinal cord injury is referral bias clearly affects different centers to a greater or lesser extent and practice standards. And so in some areas, for example, taking care of people with cancer, especially metastatic disease, advanced stage disease, sometimes it's difficult for people in that circumstance to access inpatient rehabilitation at a spinal cord center. Whereas in other places, they may accept that. For conditions such as a vascular malformation, people may travel to see a specialist who can treat that condition. And as a result, a particular center may see many more people with Dural AV fistulas or AV malformations, et cetera, thereby accounting for a larger patient population in one center for one set of conditions. So we, for example, see probably 15% of our cases are vascular etiology cases, some of those being related to high-risk aneurysm interventions and aortic dissection procedures, but a lot of them also related to malformations of dural AV fistulas, AVMs, cavernomas, et cetera.
So for our professional listenership, Ron said it, we got really good at treating traumatic spinal cord injury, or maybe you prefer the term managing, and here we are, the time is now to integrate non-traumatic. So moving on to the kind of more technical details of that, really simple question, maybe Dr. Burns, you can open us up with this one, but can the INSCI exam be used to neurologically classify non-traumatic spinal cord injury?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the International Standards Committee of Asia is going to be specifically addressing it with our next set of clarifications about the standards. In most cases, the majority of cases, it is completely appropriate to use the international standards, the INSCI or the Asia exam, to classify patients with non-traumatic conditions. The deciding thing is that there needs to be an identifiable level, because some of the definitions are things in relation to level and counting, you know, below a level. So there has to be some normal cord that transitions to abnormal cord as you move caudally. So for a condition that is diffusely affecting the cord, hereditary spastic paraplegia or something like that, it doesn't make sense that there would be a clear-cut level transitioning from normal to abnormal. But for most of the causes, it is appropriate to do a classification and a level could be determined. Now, I will admit these exams can take a long time because it's usually an incomplete injury at a cervical level and checking sensation and many dermatomes. So they're not necessarily easy exams, but the classification can be done, and definitely within the VA registry that exists, virtually all of the patients, there's an attempt for the non-traumatic ones to apply a classification to them.
Do you think, Steve, that the prognostic utility of the INSCI exam will be different in non-traumatic patients than it is in traumatic patients?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, that's been my clinical experience as well. But it's a little different thing with a acute traumatic onset versus something that has come on a little, you know, more subacute onset. The cord pathology is going to be completely different as well. Certainly with slowly progressive degenerative things, you know, what would you even time the date of, you know, onset as around that?
I think it would be a great thing for the international standards committees to think about how we could pare down the exam to essential elements that are prognostically useful in non-traumatic spinal cord injury. Because as you alluded to, time for the exam is one of the big challenges, for example, especially the sensory part. And since we know the majority of people with non-traumatic SCI are incomplete, the critical thing of discerning complete for incomplete maybe could also be made more kind of just surgically or, you know, precisely focused. One could imagine, for example, maybe a motor exam and a sacral segment exam, and then maybe a few key dermatomal points or something like that.
Yeah, the similar approach to what is described in the expedited INSCI exam, which is appropriate for traumatic or non-traumatic. So the focus of the exam is on defining the level, the NLI, and defining the injury completeness, and trying to leave out as much of the rest of the exam as possible, but get the precision for the NLI and the AIS for the injury severity. Absolutely.
Yeah, great.
I think it speaks to the need for some tool to communicate at least a baseline of status to our patients and start the conversation around expectations. We've got such great information on how to break the news about spinal cord injury, really more geared toward our traumatic population. But it's also a very challenging conversation to have when it comes to a non-traumatic SCI, where someone maybe took 3 months to even get an accurate diagnosis. And now we don't even know what that means in terms of their function moving forward. So hopefully the INSCI can be at least the starting point to begin that conversation. Although we may not use it yet for prognostication, it's better than nothing. Right.
You know, and I think that the fact that we're talking about non-traumatic spinal cord injury as a single thing, when actually it's not, right? Like when you break it down into the different etiologies, they may all have different trajectories and different functional pathways and implications in terms of recovery and neurologic recovery and prognosis. So it's a lot of subgroups we're talking about.
And one of the things we do know is, you know, as an entity, survival with a disease of the spinal cord, a non-traumatic spinal cord condition, is worse than survival from a traumatic condition. And that probably is because many of these end up ultimately being progressive disorders over time, even though in some cases we don't really think about them as progressive disorders. And so cervical stenosis, for example, one wouldn't necessarily think about as a progressive diagnosis. But if one thinks about the potential failure of the surgical construct, adjacent segment disease, the likelihood of stenosis at other levels, and the need for additional intervention, it's also easy to imagine a cascade of events that for what we might think as static disease actually is more progressive anyway. And so survival, predicting survival in non-traumatic spinal cord injury, the most robust predictor is actually diagnosis. It's a stronger predictor of survival than neurologic impairment or neurologic level.
I think this is a great conversation about sort of the challenges about trying to classify the non-traumatic SCI. You know, one of the other things that you all noted was trying to just dichotomize between traumatic and non-traumatic, just to go the example of like a cervical myelopathy, somebody that may have like a cervical stenosis and then maybe they fall and they have a central cord or something like that. And, you know, how are we going to classify them? Which examination are we going to do for them? The evolution of the diagnosis over time, when exactly did this condition start? Because symptoms probably, as you mentioned, are progressive. Would you all mind kind of discussing any more challenges that you think will come up through the process of trying to do this classification?
Sure. So we had some run-in with that exact issue when we began looking at the VA data, and I actually thought it was one of the more interesting epidemiologic aspects of the data, more so than the population demographics, that the, you know, patients were a little older and more likely to have incomplete injuries and, you know, less likely to be cervical level. That all kind of fit with what had already been published about non-traumatics. And I think Kristen mentioned that Rick Hansen was seeing this as well. Selection of a specific diagnosis, a non-traumatic other, seems to be overused if somebody, you know, clinician is choosing the diagnoses. For us, I think it was initially like 15 or 20% of the patients when we looked at recent onset ones. And when we did a chart review ourselves of a sample of them, it was almost always clear cut what it was, but maybe there was something a little ambiguous that, you know, the person, they had a fall, but it wasn't clear that they got worse with the fall, but when they had the fall was when the severe cervical stenosis and abnormal cord signal was detected, or sometimes a bit of a diagnostic uncertainty. What ended up being really interesting was that we had another data source, a separate database for patients that got their inpatient rehab in the VA, where someone else other than the clinician had classified the etiology on these same cases. So we had two different, you know, independent determinations of etiology, and it was a substantial percentage of the patients where the non-traumatic, if they had a non-traumatic etiology in the other database, it didn't agree. A good number of them were degenerative spine in one and a fall in the other. So that situation of, we don't know, was, you know, pre-existing stenosis, did they have a myelopathy and then they fell? Is this all due to the fall? and, you know, or ones where that non-traumatic other had been selected in one and the other somebody had been more clear cut. So it's very different than the traumatic situation. It's like, well, yes, it was a car crash. Yes, it was a, you know, gunshot. There's no lack of clarity. Whereas on this, where we think etiology would certainly be an important thing, as Kristen was saying, and, you know, prognosis is probably very dependent on the specific non-traumatic etiology. There's a bit of a challenge of probably these databases need a category of like a multiple. There's, you know, traumatic superimposed on a non-traumatic, and not just dichotomizing it into a one or the other, or you know, having a we can't be sure category. That would probably improve the consistency of the coding versus making somebody choose, oh, what, it's either a traumatic or a non-traumatic.
Yeah, I totally agree, Stephen. That is exactly what we found with the registry. Is people are having a really hard time in terms of not so cut and dry how to categorize these people into the international SCI datasets etiology categories, and so we're having to do a lot of data cleaning on that other category. We found that. It's definitely been helpful. We're doing ongoing kind of training and case study based training with a lot of our data collectors to try and improve that, but continues to be a challenge. I think the other piece you were talking about in terms of the more guidance or at least agreement and consensus on how to categorize those that are like the myelopathies that have a fall that then may result in a worsening of their cord injury. From the fall, are they traumatic? Are they non-traumatic? I think having some agreement and consensus on that at an international level would be really helpful. I think the other thing we've found that can be a struggle is onset date. Obviously, with a traumatic spinal cord injury, there is an event. It happens on a specific date. Whereas when the onset is more gradual, often with a non-traumatic cord injury, can be hard to kind of peg that onset date. We were surprised in the registry. We're seeing that it's being very well completed, at least the kind of month and year following that standard of the international data sets where it's the date of that first physician visit for their symptoms related to their spinal cord injury. But I mean, I don't know that there's a way to check the accuracy of that because it's really based on clinical notes and patient recall. And so I think that onset date and really pegging that for this group is a challenge.
Yeah, VA opted toward date that the diagnosis was made, which is slightly different, and you know, can be, you know, more, you know, more recent than when someone first saw a healthcare provider for the symptoms. Especially when somebody learns more about their disorder, they oh yeah, that whatever I saw somebody for 2 years ago, that probably was due to this condition that was eventually diagnosed. But you know, usually it's expensive imaging study that leads to the correct diagnosis, and that's a kind of a more clear point in time where somebody came up with that. So it's not necessarily the full story of what should we be recording related to the onset. You know, the reality may be that we should try to record, you know, up to three different dates, you know, when somebody first developed symptoms, when they saw a healthcare provider for the symptoms, when it was diagnosed, you know, and maybe the, you know, also the date if they received a surgical procedure, when that was. It's different things we could time it off of. I think the, you know, reliability, you know, asking the patient repeatedly or reviewing the records is going to vary for all of those, and for some of the some reasons for the analyses, we might want to choose a, you know, a different one of those. But also, yeah, very different from traumatic. It's, you know, we know the moment that the car crash happened or the gunshot happened.
Yeah, and I think for the New Zealand Spinal Cord Injury Registry, they're finding the same thing and have switched to using admission date. So
I think this issue of diagnostic precision is really important. And of course, one of the things that definitely happens is we learn over time. And so your point, Dr. Burns, about being able to capture multiple relevant diagnoses and or revision of diagnoses over time will be critical for the field going forward. it would not be unusual at all for someone to present with a gait disorder and abnormal EMG examination and a cervical stenosis. And they'll get cervical spine surgery for that, but then maybe a year and a half later are diagnosed with ALS. And so was their gait disorder related to their stenosis, or was it ALS and they got asymptomatic stenosis treated? Of course, there's no way of ever answering that question, but being able to capture that level of information in longitudinal databases will definitely help us learn more as a field over time. And there are many, many other kind of comparable situations. So the cord signal abnormality that seems a little more extensive than what can be explained by the stenosis, but you can fix the stenosis. And so they get an operation anyway, but perhaps it's an inflammatory disease or some other condition that's causing cord signal abnormality. And then a year or two later, what's going on declares itself. So in some cases, we know very high rate of diagnosis change. So idiopathic transverse myelitis may end up being a revised diagnosis 75% of the time in some centers. So people come in with a nonspecific diagnosis and then ultimately exit with a more specific diagnosis, which might be NMO or something else.
I think I recall a study showing about a 40% rate of carpal tunnel surgery on patients who very soon thereafter are diagnosed with degenerative cervical spine myelopathy.
Yeah, great example.
All right, as we're looking to the future here, maybe, Chiara, you can open us up with a use case you have for trying to implement this with malignant tumor.
Yeah, so I think in general, if you're with a healthcare organization or at a small hospital system or outpatient center, anything like that, and you wanted to start to identify some trends within your own organization or add to the database in the end, I think it's really important from the beginning to really accurately code these patients. I think one thing that I see a lot is that the people who are doing maybe capturing the ICD-10 codes from patient charts really rely on specific language in the medical record, rely on the acute care hospital to have specific information in there. And then for us on the inpatient rehab side to copy that information over and or add to it with accurate classification information. And if we don't do that, then we're not capturing those patients already from that key moment at the beginning, and maybe not cycling our resources into that space, right? Seeing patients with degenerative myelopathy then on a typical rehab floor who maybe aren't aware that this individual needs to be on a bowel program. It's the type of thing we see all the time. But even in a model system center or in a great hospital, people can fall through the cracks, and it really comes back down to the way that we're documenting and the way that we're tracking our patient outcomes. So I really encourage you, no matter who you are, right? I'm an occupational therapist that myself developed a database for tracking within my own hospital because I felt like we had a lot of patients with cancer that we weren't capturing using our RIC group coding, right? So patients may be falling into the non-traumatic SCI rehab impairment code in the inpatient rehab hospital. And I was finding that there was upwards of 20% of our patients were getting missed from that group. So that's a big population that we're not really capturing what their outcomes look like. So I think it's really important that we, as you know, all of our clinicians are looking to track our patient outcomes and coming together, right? You don't have to have all the answers. You don't have to know exactly what to do with that patient with this B12 deficiency, right? You're not Ron Reeves. So that's okay, right? So then you can look for that access, look for those resources, look for those, you know, articles that can do that. We can't all be the specialists in every single condition, specifically within the spectrum of non-traumatic SCI. So when it comes to something like metastatic cancer, most of our rehab docs and our rehab teams are not comfortable with addressing the elephant in the room. We're not comfortable talking about metastatic cancer. And we typically try to then just address the spinal cord injury itself. My perspective is we're not doing enough then, right? We need to be able, this is an individual with cancer first and foremost, who's now presenting with a spinal cord injury. We need to be able to navigate the oncologic side just as much as we're navigating the spinal cord injury side of things. So I really encourage you to streamline kind of what your resources are and consider what, how you may educate that person about neurogenic bowel and bladder if they are presenting with a traumatic spinal cord injury or a non-traumatic spinal cord injury from a tumor, but also consider what prognosis may look like for them from an oncologic perspective, in addition to a functional perspective, and be creative with some of the solutions that you come up with.
And I think you raise a great point, Kira, about, in particular, how we think about cancer now, perhaps, as opposed to what many of us might have been exposed to 10 or 20 years ago in training, because the advent of new treatments and more effective treatments, whether it be proton beam therapy or immunotherapy, immune checkpoint inhibitors, has definitely improved survival for many, many diseases, many causes of cancer, which then also makes rehabilitation a very important part of returning people back to their community and their family to enjoy the time that advances in cancer treatment have delivered in terms of survival improvements. So lung cancer, breast cancer, many, many things have, survival has improved very dramatically with the advent of new therapies in the last decade.
Within the VA system of care, in our directive that defines which populations get treated in the SCI centers, there has been wording that says that patients with malignant tumors, metastatic to the spine, may not be appropriate for the centers, and it definitely a case-by-case decision with this kind of old, you know, philosophy of, you know, will these patients fit in on the unit, long length of stay, and having goals that may be different. But it's not an absolute in any way. And I've encouraged my staff that the story is very different. This person has metastatic prostate cancer, but they're 60 years old, no pre-existing health conditions, you know, just diagnosed at the very, you know, start of the treatments. They're not that they've failed everything so long. That person may have a reasonable prognosis to live a couple of years, as opposed to some of these other patients with, you know, other non-traumatic conditions that don't have a great prognosis, and the person is in their early 80s and, you know, probably isn't going to live 2 years themselves. And we're, you know, why would we say no to the guy who's got a better, you know, better chance for longer life expectancy with all the resources we have? A little problem with our data collection is that we're still using the etiology classification that we had in our registry 30 years ago. We didn't exactly adopt yet the what's in the international one, and we can't break apart malignant from benign tumors in the registry the way it exists. So that's a modification I've been suggesting that we add in, because the prognosis is so different. It looks like across the VA SCI centers that the composition of the registry, as far as what percentage are due to a tumor etiology, varies by a factor of three between the centers. So it shows me that there are probably different practices to who they're choosing to rehabilitate on in the centers versus having the care happen on, you know, medicine and more limited rehab services coming through the spinal cord system.
And I think that variation of who admits cancer care is sort of common across both U.S., European, and worldwide centers. And I think you make a great point, Dr. Burns, about how we think about diagnoses. Because one of the things that I think is also an interesting finding is that an ischemic myelopathy has a relatively limited survival expectation, but it's an acute paraplegia in most cases. And I think many people would admit that individual to a rehab unit to receive care. But the survival of that population of people with ischemic myelopathy, likely because of all of the other associated vascular disease, is quite limited in many ways. It's substantially less than survival regarding or for almost all other causes of non-traumatic myelopathy, except metastatic cancer, right? Metastatic cancer clearly is associated with a restriction of survival, but ischemic disease is pretty difficult as well, unfortunately. So
I just wanted to chime in really quickly, and I really want to thank the discussion around cancer, because we've been dealing within our membership of individuals that are living with who are living with cancer and bladder cancer and bowel cancer because of the difficulties in voiding, you know, as people without spinal cord injury are able to do functionally, and toxins stay in the body longer. And so we're looking also at the types of supplies, medical supplies that are used, and some of the materials that are used with those medical supplies that are have to be in the body, catheters, for example. There are different types of catheters, different materials that need to be looked at to help limit or reduce, you know, the cancer incidence. So that's definitely a huge thing within our population that we've been looking at. So I really do appreciate the focus of this important issue from everyone.
And for the pioneers that we have here on this expert panel, can we talk a little bit about what you're starting to see with the data collection that you have initiated in advance of other major centers starting to focus in on non-traumatic? So maybe, Kristen, you can tell us a little bit, starting off from Canada and Praxis, some data, initial preliminary data, maybe related to etiology, gender, age, neurological level of injury, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. I can give you kind of a snapshot of what we're starting to see. So like I said, we started collecting data on non-trauma in 2020, but are only collecting it on individuals with new non-traumatic injuries in their first inpatient rehab stay at our specialized rehab centers. So just the context that that is a small piece of all individuals out there with non-traumatic injuries. But what we're seeing is, like I said, in terms of age, the average age we're seeing for non-traumatics is around 62 versus traumatics being 55. Slightly more females having non-traumatic injuries than traumatic injuries. In terms of neurology, really aligns with what Dr. Burns was saying in terms of the majority at 94% having incomplete injuries. And overall, slightly more having incomplete paraplegia injuries versus tetraplegic injuries. So kind of 50% versus 43%. In terms of etiology, it sounds like what we're seeing, I think, largely aligns with what's in the literature and what the VA has seen in terms of about 52% having degenerative injuries. Our total tumor group is about 19%, with 12% being malignant tumor and 7% being benign. Followed by infection at 10% and vascular disorders just under that at 9%. And the rest being lower and kind of in those inflammatory, genetic, metabolic etiologies. So what we're seeing, I think, largely aligns, I think, in terms of kind of what we've learned through this process is, like Yara was saying, you need to start somewhere and you need to start with a consistent way to assign a classification to people with non-traumatic injuries so you're able to capture those injuries. We are looking at, with the registry, you know, we report back to all of our clinicians at our centers in terms of things like complications, functional outcomes. And so that's now being broken down through the non-trauma and the trauma group separately. But I think, you know, one of our large learnings is that in Canada, we really need to learn more about what that journey looks like for people with non-traumatic cord injuries. You know, given that they've got different types of primary conditions that result in their spinal cord injury, their journeys really all look quite different. And so the registry, like I say, is a piece and kind of been the starting place. And we're capturing some information about how people are getting into inpatient rehab. And how long they're staying, and so we can start to learn. But I think We're also at Praxis, we now have access to our Canadian Institute for Health Information data, which covers all of our provinces except Quebec. So really wanting to start to look at that bigger picture in terms of incidence and prevalence and kind of flow through the healthcare system, to start to look at that and then maybe start to be able to put some costing to it, to help in terms of advocacy. The Network in Canada, given how broad non-traumatic spinal cord injury is kind of agreed to start with degenerative cervical myelopathy as a start nationally, because it's such a big group. But there are lots of groups working in other areas like oncology. And I think there's really a need to continue to collect all of the groups and with organizations, the larger organizations, to be able to do things like standardize how we're collecting so that we can start to, as Ron was saying earlier, put this data together, because some of these etiology groups are quite small. So to be able to answer any of our questions, we're going to have to be able to combine that information.
So taking the lessons we've learned from our colleagues up north and our colleagues in New Zealand, any final thoughts from our panelists here about, you know, what is necessary, or any call to action for our scholarly community about how we need to kind of move forward from here in this quest to start classification for our non-traumatic SCI?
One of the things that is on the to-do list, but is a non-insignificant amount of work, is to develop a data dictionary to provide more explicit guidance for case classification in relation to the international non-traumatic SCI data sets. And so that is a project which is starting to move forward, but will take a while before that would be complete, just given the enormous range of diagnoses and the process to develop a consensus about how to define each of those things and kind of work through some of these nuances. For example, as Kristen mentioned, the person who might fall and also have a cervical stenosis, and is that a traumatic injury or is that a non-traumatic myelopathy that simply presents as a result of the fall? But that's a clear need for the field, because we do know that probably as many as 10% of cases will be categorized differently by different people in different centers, and that variability will undermine some of the population subgroups, because they'll be hard to aggregate together.
I think it's still going to be not an easy task for non-traumatic to be fully integrated with model systems activities. When I first heard a rumor that, oh, there's some talk of this happening, and I mentioned it to a senior researcher at one of the model systems sites, she said, ha, you know, it took an act of Congress to get the model systems started in the first place. It's going to take an act of Congress to get non-traumatic to be part of it. But, the model system sites that already treat a lot of patients with non-traumatic and have expertise in this, you know, and interest, are going to have to, you know, do their part in moving this along. And, you know, we've mentioned some of the data collection and accuracy considerations that are different with this population. It's not going to be an easy thing, but there's really no justification for the resources that go into the model systems and development of the National SCI Statistical Center and database to be focused exclusively on traumatic, with the complete exclusion of non-traumatic. It's just an accident of how the model systems evolved around the trauma care system in the 1970s that leaves us to be in that situation where the research may not be fully benefiting those individuals with non-traumatic, which, you know, in my VA population, is the majority of the new injuries that come in are non-traumatics. So I think a lot of attention from those of us that have interest in this, and it's, you know, sooner or later it has to be. It just can't be justified to be excluding them from this national level data collection and research that goes on. we need to know more about these conditions.
Yeah, I think with that, the numbers are growing and we're going to be seeing more and more of these patients. So even though it is a little bit more challenging to begin those classifications and to maybe do an INSCI exam and start tracking some of that data, it's really just something we need to start doing as decent spinal cord clinicians from here on out.
We couldn't agree more. And we know that Asia's podcast listenership is behind this because, as we say, it won't be easy and it will happen. So here we are. Thank you all so much for being with us. And for our listeners, we look forward to catching you on the next one.
We would like to thank and acknowledge our panel members for their participation in today's episode. Today's panel members included Alexandra Benowith is a steering committee co-chair and member of multiple coalitions and committees, including the Academy of Spinal Cord Injury Professionals Advocacy Committee, the American Spinal Injury Association's Outreach Committee, the Independence Through the Enhancement of Medicare and Medicaid Coalition, the Coalition to Preserve Rehabilitation, as well as the Multiple Sclerosis Coalition. Ms. Benowith has also been a guest lecturer and project director for American University's Master of Public Policy Practicum on Spinal Cord Injury Healthcare and Access, as well as a principal investigator of multiple subgrantee projects in urology research, as well as an advisor to various academic institutions on healthcare disparities access. Ms. Benowith has over 25 years of government affairs and public affairs experience. She has a Bachelor of Arts from Brandeis University and a Master of Public Administration from American University.
Proceeding in alphabetical order by last name, Dr. Stephen Burns is a physiatrist who serves as the Director of Spinal Cord Injury Services at the Veterans Affairs Peugeot Sound and is a professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. He is a member and past chair of the American Spinal Injury Association's International Standards Committee, and he participated in the development of the SCI patient registry currently used by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Kira McNair has practiced occupational therapy for over 13 years, primarily working in the inpatient rehabilitation setting with a specialization in assistive technology and non-traumatic spinal cord injury. Ms. McNair currently serves as clinical faculty within the Rutgers University Occupational Therapy Doctorate Program and an advanced clinical specialist and occupational therapist at Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation, in addition to pursuing a PhD in health sciences. Ms. McNair is an active member of the Asia Education Committee and leads the Non-Traumatic SCI Subcommittee. She is also an active member of the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine, SCI-ISIG, and serves as the Non-Traumatic SCI Task Force Lead. Ms. McNair's scholarship includes best practices in inpatient cancer rehabilitation, predicting prognosis for individuals with neoplastic-related SCI, as well as identifying factors related to acute care transfer and mortality for individuals with cancer admitted to inpatient rehabilitation. Her current research includes development and implementation of community-based programs for young adults with SCI.
Dr. Ron Reeves is an associate professor of PM&R, physical medicine and rehabilitation, at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota. He has been active with several Asia committees and served the board of the directors from 2013 to 2019. Due to large subspecialized clinical practice at Mayo Clinic, non-traumatic spinal cord conditions outnumber traumatic spinal cord injuries by a factor of 2 to 3 to 1 in his practice. This large volume of patients has allowed Dr. Reeves and colleagues to explore outcomes related to non-traumatic spinal cord disorders, as you heard in today's episode, including those for rare disorders such as fibrocartilaginous embolic myelopathy, epidural lipomatosis, vascular myelopathy, and viral myelitis, for example.
Kristen Walden is currently the Associate Director of Clinical Programs for the Praxis Spinal Cord Institute and a physiotherapist at Vancouver Coastal Health in Vancouver, BC, Canada. The focus of her research involvement and clinical practice has been in the area of spinal cord injury. Clinically, she has practiced in the area of SCI for over 20 years, working with individuals in intensive care, acute care, as well as both inpatient and outpatient rehabilitation settings. In her role at Praxis, Kristen works on a number of research and best practice initiatives, including the development and implementation of the Standing and Walking Assessment Tool, the Rick Hansen Spinal Cord Injury Registry, and the Canadian Activity-Based Therapy Community of Practice. Additionally, she leads a Praxis collaboration with ISCOS on the development of the freely available web-based International Standards for Neurologic Classification of SCI algorithm, and is a member of the American Spinal Cord Injury Association's International Standards Committee.
And just as a reminder to our listeners for this special panel, both episodes will be published, The Scholarly and the Community, and you are invited to engage with both of these conversations. Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The topic of this episode was suggested to us by Asia's Education Committee. The podcast is made possible by the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh, your producer host, myself, Marla Petrello, our editor, Abby Fox, production assistant, James, and Asia's front office. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please contact us at sciperspectivespodcast@gmail.com.